present and hope you'll begin this hour with us. Our purpose is to study the will of God. Last Sunday morning, we began a study on the use of intoxicants. I intended for it to only go one sermon, but it stretched into two. And so we're going to go back and do a little bit of review, hopefully not in any way of that which is boringly redundant to everybody who was here last time, but just getting our thoughts along the line and then trying to get into some passages that will discuss this idea of, does the Bible teach that a moderate drinking of intoxicants is acceptable? Last time we noticed the fact that there is some discussion about that idea of whether we can drink, and by that we mean intoxicants, without getting drunk, and that that level of defining drunkenness is growingly difficult with some. Some would even say that getting a buzz or a little bit of that kind of a feeling of happy is not a problem. What does the Bible say about that? When we talked about what is a drink of alcohol, we noted the fact that whether you're talking about wine, beer, whatever it might be, one of those is what is called a drink. Two of those is that which gets you legally drunk. So one kind of beer, one glass of wine, one cocktail, whatever you want to call it, is equivalent in alcohol about the same thing, no matter which drink you choose. When you look at the Old Testament, we had noted the fact that the proverb writer, the wise man, had pointed out, do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkleth in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly. At the last it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. To that degree, the words really of the Old Testament use of this concept of intoxicants, it was pointed out as being that which one needed to abstain from. Not to use moderately, but to abstain from, and to recognize that it was something that threatened the very core of their holiness in Leviticus chapter 10. That when the priests were to do their service, they were to keep away from that. Why? Because the very start of that affected the idea of their holiness and their discretion to be able to determine what was right and what was wrong. When you look at the Old Testament words for wine, we notice the fact that we cannot use those in the same way we do for the word wine today. When you look at the Old Testament, there are three words. The first one has reference to that which is grape juice. The second, that which is strong drink and never approved of at all for that which is a consumption by man. And that third one, yayin or yanin, is one that is used sometimes as something that may be approved, something that is condemned the vast predominant number of times. And it can be used with regard to that which is grape juice as well, though at times it is used, and more predominantly used, I might say, of that which has some level of fermentation about it. When we go in the New Testament, we noticed the fact last week that the New Testament describes not only the sin of drunkenness, those first three there pointing out that idea of the drunk, or first four rather, the drunkenness, but in the last two, dealing with something that led in that direction. In Romans chapter 13, the point was an intoxication that was there was a work of darkness, not just the full one, but that kind of a happy idea as well. That also was condemned. 1 Peter chapter 4 is what we're going to talk about in just a minute, so I asked you to stay there. But in Ephesians chapter 5, the point was made that Paul condemned the wine wherein is riot. He's not talking about the use of the wine being riotous. He talked about wine wherein is riot. Grammatically, both in the English and in the original language, that's the point. We notice the idea that's behind that was that the Greeks used the word wine or oinos in such a way that they described normally that which was water mixed with what we would call wine. And if you took the ratio, it varied all the way from about 20 to 1 to about 3 to 1 to be the ratio, normally in the range of 8 to 1 to 4 to 1 would be what would be called a normal mixture of that. We took the best possible case. If you took alcoholic wine in Old Testament times and New Testament times in the Bible lands, it's generally pointed out that the maximum fermentation was about 6%. We said let's bump it up to 8 because one source gives that as the maximum alcohol by natural fermentation level. Then you cut that with the least. Not 8 or 4 parts water to wine, but 3. What do you have? You have a drink that's 2% alcohol by volume. Now, that which was presented there has no equivalent in our time at all. If somebody wants to talk about cutting something down to that level so that you can purify the water that you have that isn't real pure, we'll talk about whether you need to do that as far as wisdom. But beyond that, one can't even begin to make a case for the drinking of alcohol beyond that level. If we took it to the point of about 8 or 6% alcohol by volume, which is probably more the idea, we cut it 4 to 1, which is really on the minimum end of what was to be done actually, then you'd have to drink at a level of about 2.5 to 3 gallons per hour to have that drunkenness versus 2 drinks. Now, are we talking about the same thing when we discuss the drinking of intoxicants today and what was done in that time? The obvious answer is no. That when one drinks the intoxicants of our day, the point is, it is specifically condemned. There isn't a thing in the world you could drink that is not called strong drink in the Bible and absolutely condemned. A wine wherein is right. So just on that level, there's no positive authority that anyone could get for that. I want us to remember that. But then I want us to go on and notice what it says in 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 1 through 4. Remember what we started with. I as a Christian need to prove all things, hold fast that which I can prove to be good. There isn't a passage I can use to say that the drinking of an intoxicant is good. That's what we've established already. Now beyond that, what we find is that this idea of a moderate recreational, social, or any other non-medicinal use of wine is something that not only do we not have authority for, it is specifically forbidden in the text of the New Testament. In the American Standard Version that I use, he talks about, "Forasmuch then as Christ suffered in the flesh, arm ye yourselves also with the same mind, for he that has suffered in the flesh hath ceased from sin, that ye no longer should live the rest of your time in the flesh to the lust of men, but to the will of God. For the time past may suffice to have wrought the desires of the Gentiles, and to have walked in lasciviousness," lusts. And then there are these three words that we're going to look at: wine bibbings, revelings, carousings, and abominable idolatries, wherein they think it strange that ye run not with them into the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you. It's obvious that those three are talking about some level of intoxication. When you look at the King James Version, there are the words excess of wine, reveling, and banquetings that are used. Other versions will use other words. Well, what are they? Well, the words that are used in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 3 point out first that there's a difference in these things that are talked about in two different ways of life. One is a life that's after the flesh, and one's a life that is after the mind of God. Those two are opposites one with another. And so it's important for us to understand that whatever's associated with this in 1 Peter chapter 4, 3 is not a part of the mind of Christ, which we're to be filled with, but it is a part of that which is the lust of men. These lists that are included talk about a decreasing level of alcoholic consumption and of inebriation. The first, wine bibbings, excess of wine, the word oinophlogia. The second, revelings or komos. And then the word carousings or banquetings, the word patas. I want to start with this one. Oinophlogia talks about somebody who is a drunk or a drunkenness, the spate of it. Trench says it marks a step in advance of methe, which is just the normal word that was used of drunkenness. Here's somebody who is involved in that which is of dissipation in their life. They're a falling down drunk, if you will. The one who's in oinophlogia has lost all control. It was used to talk about Aristotle and what happened when his body was harmed and ultimately he died in a drunken stupor. It's used in such a way of that debauching in other cases as well. So what we have here is somebody who's like this fellow on the lamp, or on the pole here, the light pole. He's just falling down drunk. You've seen those, right? I've seen those. You can recognize those kind of people. They're ones who are just about to pass out due to the use of their alcoholic beverage. Now, that's condemned. That's wrong. And I think everybody would say, well, yeah, that's wrong. But that's not all. Then there's the word revelings, comas. This word, aren't in Gingrich, which is the most normally the most credible source that you would look at for Koine Greek usage and definitions, says it was originally a festival procession in honor of Dionysius, is what that word was used for. Then a joyous meal of banquet in the New Testament times. Only in the bad sense of excessive feasting, he says, is it used in the New Testament. Never with regard to that idea of just a meal or a banquet, but that which is of excess involved in it. Thayer talked about it as a nocturnal and riotous procession of half-drunken and frolicsome fellows who after supper parade through the streets with torches and music in honor of Bacchus, that's the Greek name for Dionysius. Bacchus is the Roman name, the Latin name for Dionysius in the Greek, of some other deity, and sing and play before houses of their male and female friends. Hence, used generally of feasts and drinking parties that are protracted till late at night and indulge in revelry. That idea of somebody who's just a happy drunk, they've still got all their facilities around them. They're still able to motivate and go to different places. That's what's talked about here with this particular use. Well, that's not all that's condemned. When you look at this one, you'd see what's happening at the bar scene. You'd see what's happening at Mardi Gras or some other party kind of an atmosphere like that, which is usually where the drinking takes place. These are all condemned in that way. But there's another word. And that word is the word carousings or patas. That word simply talks about a drinking that is not of necessity excessive, but giving opportunity for excess, Trench points out. Kiestemacher notes that this is something that is of that which is not excessive, but something that could develop in that life. When you look at the primary word for the word, or meaning for this word, it simply means a drinking. In other forms you have of this word, there's the word paterion, the cup, is what you drink from. You have the word patizo, I drink. And all you have is this word, patas, is another form of that same thing. In context, it talks about a drinking that is of intoxicants. No doubt about that. Why do I know that? Because the one who used it ultimately was a falling down drunk. The one that used it a little bit less was somebody who was just a happy drunk. And now we got the guy who starts out with a drinking. That's what this word means. If you were going to look at this, it's a summary. Or in summary, you would look at it as the exact equivalent of what some people would call the moderate drinker. The one who's just going to start to use that wine wherein is right, but not necessarily to excess, just beginning along that line. Now, so I would say, well, how in the world am I supposed to know that? It doesn't say that in the English language. Certainly, we should be ones who should be able to understand something from the English. You know, in every case, you and I have to look for a translation or we wouldn't be able to know anything about the Bible. There's a fact about that. It wasn't written in English. And it certainly wasn't written in American English where I could understand that just by taking the original words. Somebody had to translate it, right? Now, who translated it? Well, I could say originally in the English, what was called the English, Wycliffe did. But if you took the Wycliffe Bible, you know what? You wouldn't be able to understand that either. You know why? Because it had forms of English that are something that are absolutely unreadable today to us in English. We don't understand that. So what had to happen? In different times, it had to be given in translations to different places so that they could understand this. In almost every other language that I know of, I've dealt with Russian, I've dealt with Lithuanian, I've dealt with some of the Eastern European languages, I've dealt with the various cases of dialects over in the Philippines. And in almost all of those, you have translations that truly translate these words. And almost every one of them, what you can find out is that it's talking about a lesser level of intoxication. And with every single one of them that I know about, I've asked people who are native speakers, you take that book that you have, that Bible that you have, and you just read that. What does that mean? I remember the first time I did that with a translator that was there with us in Lithuania. I asked her. She was somebody who I used in classes a lot and talking with people. And I said, I want you to tell me what these three words mean. She looked the first one. She said, oh, that's somebody who passed out. I said, oh, okay. Passed out, drunk, yeah. What does that second one mean? Oh, that's just somebody that's out there drinking and having fun. That was her words. I said, what about that third word? She said, That just says somebody who drinks. She looked at me and she said, I do that. I said, what does that passage say about it? She said, I've never seen that before. I said, but what does it say about it? She said, it says what I do is wrong. She got it. Any time that we're going to look at a passage and we're going to see a word that's not familiar to us, one of the first things that we do when we study the scripture is go back and get a definition of that word. There is no one who can fairly go to sources, either commentators or lexicographers or wherever they might want to go back and fairly look for the definition of this word without understanding what it means. And what it means is, when I go out there and I take something that is an intoxicant, whether it's beer or wine or a mixed drink or whatever it might be, I'm sinning with the very first one. That's what it means. Why? Because what I'm involving myself in is the start of a process that is wrong all the way through. You can't start out a process in holiness and good and by doing the very same thing end up in evil. And that's why the starting of that process of drinking is wrong and needs to be avoided. It necessarily implies that the moderate use, so-called, of intoxicants is indeed sinful. When you look at the case to justify the so-called moderate drinker, we have to ask ourselves, where is it? There's a condemnation of wine wherein is excess. This excludes the drinking of modern intoxicants. So it's not there. I've got a problem just from what would be drunk. 1 Peter 4 leaves no room for such because I understand it condemns drunkenness to a loss of control, the so-called buzz or party time, happy time. And it condemns a lesser level that would be there than those. Now my question is, what level would that condemn? You and I both know the fellow who's falling down drunk, that's sinful. The one who's out here and he gets a buzz, he's the happy partier, he's doing that which is sinful. Now there's a lesser level. What level is that? That's before you get that buzz, isn't it? That's before I would come to that point of having that kind of a happy inebriate point. What level is that? There's only one choice. That's before that has begun to bring on what we recognize as drunkenness. And that level, 1 Peter 4:3 says, is that which is condemned. The main and primary question, however, I want to go back to and recall. The main question is, where is the passage authorizing a moderate use of intoxicants as good? Because Paul pointed out in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 21, prove all things, hold fast that which is good. If I said, well, I don't believe what that preacher says about 1 Peter 4. All right. You just go away from all of that. You leave all of the things that are there. It's not just me. It's not just some preacher over here who's ultra radical and conservative that says that. You'd go to various denominational sources and you could find the same exact thing about the use of the words, even from people who involve themselves in drinking. But if you disregard all of that, then I want you to know something. What you have to do is be ready to stand before God and say, I'm engaging in this conduct, and here's the passage that I thought was good about it. I don't know of anyone who can give a passage and tell God, look, you told me to do it. It was good. That's why I did it. I did it to enhance the things of serving you. Mm-mm. That isn't so. And every single one of us know it. When you look at efforts to justify the practice sometimes, in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 23, the Apostle Paul, talking to Timothy, said something that is, I guess, everybody's attempt to justify drinking that I've ever seen has involved this one. And it is, be no longer a drinker of water, but use a little wine for thy stomach's sake and thine often infirmities. And so somebody says, well, that says that Timothy could do it. Now, what did it tell me about Timothy's practice up to this point? Be no longer a drinker of what? Be no longer a moderate drinker? No. Be no longer a drinker of water, solely water. Why? Because he has a stomach problem. So what's here? What's here is a medicinal use that's authorized. I don't have a problem with that. It doesn't authorize a recreational or social use. As a matter of fact, it would speak absolutely against that. When I know what is authorized, then what I recognize. Don't go beyond the Word of God. Don't add some other use that's there for it. Then what's a lot of times used is John 2, verses 1 through 11. Jesus turned water into wine. Well, what does that tell me? Remember, the word wine is not the modern equivalent of wine. We've already talked about that. It can involve that which is, in fact, grape juice. Now, if it was something that was alcoholic, let's remember the amount that was made. If we're talking about something alcoholic, 106 to 160 gallons were made. That's the amount of the measures that were there. So if that were something that was an intoxicant, Jesus provided for people to get rip-roaring drunk. Is that what we're going to say about Jesus? No. What he did was he made that which was the most valued oinos of the time. They said, you saved the best to last. Well, we've talked about this numerous times before. There's no doubt about what was most valued. Over and over again, ancient sources will tell you the fact that that which was most valued was the freshly squeezed juice of the grape. That's not difficult to understand. Now, the fact that Jesus made it, wouldn't that suggest that if it came straight from that of the power of the Creator, it would be the best any of them had ever had? Yes. And that was evident, not after it had been something that had been defiled by the fermentation process, but before that ever took place, when it was fresh from the hand of the Creator. When you look at Luke chapter 7, in Luke chapter 7, Jesus is called a wine bibber and a glutton. It's a context in which we recognize that those who were making the charge were not telling the truth about Jesus on other things. Why would they hear? But the context, as a matter of fact, describes the difference between John the Baptist and Jesus. John the Baptist was a Nazarite. A Nazarite was not able to drink of anything of a product of the grape or eat of the grape. So what's said? Jesus did do that. He partook of that. Now, does that mean he was a drunkard? No. It neither means that, nor would that be something that I think any of us would be ready to concede. If their view of it was taken literally, that Jesus was a wine bibber, that in itself is used as descriptive of sin in the Bible. Jesus never committed any sin. So why would I take that? Somebody says, well, he had to use a little bit of an intoxicant if they were going to make that. Have you ever been falsely accused of something? Has anybody ever said anything about you that had no substance in fact at all? If not, I'd really like to know you. You've had something that not most people are going to ever have, and that's a pass on false charges. But what happened? They made this charge. Why? Because they saw that he did partake of the grape. Therefore, they attributed the most awful use of that. That which was an intoxicant. Yet Jesus never did. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, there is another one that is used. And I want to take just a second on this one to talk about it, if you will. In 1 Timothy chapter 3 and in verse 3, qualifications for elders or bishops are given. In the American Standard, the use of the term is no brawler. In the King James, it says not given to wine. The King James Version is more literally correct in that particular case. That it is not given to wine. Paraoinos means he stays at the wine. Not given to wine. All right. Look in verse 8 when it talks about those who are deacons. It says, deacons in like manner must be grave, not double-tongued, not given to much wine. And the idea is, well, now deacons are not given to much wine. That means they can have a little bit, but the elders not given to wine, that means they aren't to have any. Really. In Titus chapter 2 and in verse 3, in Titus 2 and in verse 3, it says, the aged women likewise be reverent in demeanor, not slanderers, nor enslaved to much wine. So let me get this straight. If the idea is right from some of those who would like to justify this, what that means is only elders are to be non-drinkers, right? Deacons can be a little bit of drinker, and then you get to have those who are women, and they can be drinkers as well, of a little bit. Now, pray tell, how in the world would we ever qualify an elder? If what he said, maybe while I was a deacon, I could drink a little wine, so I did. Now, we're going to put him in as an elder, and somebody says, he's not given to wine at all here, so now he can't drink any, but he's got to have proved that before he was ever made an elder, you see. If everybody followed what they say is permitted, we would never have an elder. Because none of them would have been qualified by that which was of their use. The fact is that it deals with what one is not to do. When I find what one is not to do, I have no positive authority for what I am to do. And that's the point that is made here. When you look at this passage says simply, you don't be given to wine or much wine. Now let me put that this way. Don't get high on dope. Might tell a kid that. What does that mean? Does that mean, now, child of mine, you can go out and you can have a little dope, and you be sure to stop short with your use of dope before you get high? It's not what that means, is it? When we say to somebody, don't get in a fatal car accident, are we giving them the permission to get in any other kind? Don't go out there and drive 100 miles an hour. Does that mean 99's okay? We understand when we're using the statement of what not to do, that does not give an authority for them to just go barely under that line and be all right. The question is still back to number one main primary discussion, what is authorized? And what is authorized is nothing of the nature of that. Abraham Lincoln once said, alcohol has many defenders but no defense. I think that's just exactly the idea that we see in Scripture. Remember that a Christian is called to a higher calling. We're going to talk about this throughout this series. That we prove all things, hold fast that which is good. That there is a responsibility to do all in the name of the Lord or by His authority. That we must do that which is to the glory of God in all that we do. That we must work to glorify and silence those who would charge us with evil or see in us any hypocrisy. We are to be not a stumbling block to others, but if we are, Jesus said, it's good that a millstone be hanged about our neck and we cast into the sea. We do anything to keep ourselves from bringing others into a way of sin. Nor are we to cause offense, not to cause them to go into sin, but be a prophet unto them that we might help them in their service of God. That we're to live in such a way that's beyond reproach, beyond shame of evil. And we are to be those who are a light, so that men may see our good works and glorify our Father in heaven. We're to have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather even reprove them, Ephesians 5. Now there's the positive sense of what a Christian is to do. What is it? Is it to get just as close as I can to the line of sin? No. Is it to try and give a technical justification of something that I know full well, if I involve myself in that, will cause me to be looked at as lesser, not only by my brethren, but by those who are out there in the world, lesser of one who's a servant of God? The statement's very clear from the Apostle Paul. Be not unequally yoked with unbelievers. The next time that anyone is tempted to share a drink with somebody, it's probably not going to be a brother or sister in Christ. It's probably going to be somebody out there in the world who's tempting us about that. I want us to think about this passage. Don't be unequally yoked with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness and iniquity? Or what communion hath light with darkness? Or what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what portion hath a believer with an unbeliever? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For we are the temple of the living God. Even as God said, I will dwell in them and walk in them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore, come ye out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord. And touch no unclean thing, and I will receive you, and I will be to you a father, and you shall be to me sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty. Having therefore these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from, get it, all defilement of flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. There's our responsibility. It's not to be involved in things that get just as close to the line of sin as we can, and indeed, as we have pointed out, are explicitly over that line. It is for us to live in a way that perfects holiness in the fear of God, who has the love of God and the care for God so consumed in our heart that we would not in any way inebriate, pollute, or dilute that spirit of holiness with the use of any intoxicant whatsoever. The lesson's yours. There'll be a prayer at this point in time, and we'll have some